listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
To the most, Nikki Kolula. We're going to jump right into this episode. We have a very awesome artist indeed, jazz singer and songwriter, Mr. Mark Winkler. How are you, Mark?
I'm good, Nikki.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, it's been a while.
How have you been? I should ask you that first.
I'm good. Doing a lot of stuff. Maybe doing too much, actually, Nikki.
That's good, though. The busy train is always... Like, you always want to get off the train. When you're not busy, you always want to get on the busy train. So
that's true. It's true.
I like that piano you have in the back. What kind of piano is that? I know it's an upright.
I've had this piano for over 40 years, and I found out the name of it. It's not during the pandemic. I had it restrung and everything.
Right.
But the name of it, it's not a, I forgot, to be honest.
Okay, no worries.
Somewhere. I love this piano, and many songs have been written on this piano.
I have one behind me as well. It's a Kawai.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, it looks good.
And I love that. I love an upright piano. There's something about it. Of course, we all love grand pianos, but we may not all have the space for that. So an upright is just as good.
Yeah, it's its own thing. You know, it's got its... I love the sound of an upright, too. And, I love the piano. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your story with jazz. Tell me, what was the moment of Zen that you fell in love with jazz and it made you want to be a jazz artist?
Well, that's it. You know, I fell in love with jazz sort of sideways.
Okay.
My mom was a big band singer.
Oh, awesome.
So I grew up with her love of singers. So when she was playing music all the time in the house. And when we'd see movies or we'd see TV shows with singers coming on, she talked about singing and what they were doing right and what they were doing wrong. So I always liked singers. And then I started listening to this show in LA. Where are you from, Nikki?
I'm from Arcadia.
I'm a local guy. Okay, but I'm older than you. So in the 60s, there was a show on KMPC called Johnny Magnus. He was the DJ. And he would play jazz singers and jazz instrumentalists, but he would never say they were jazz. So I listened to Carmen McRae, Ella Fitzgerald, Joe Williams, and Jack Jones. And he never said the word jazz. And I love these singers. And I lived in a parallel universe, because when I was making it, there was the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Jimi Hendrix. And I liked all of that. But I also like the music of the Great American Songbook and these people. So I sort of had two tracks.
That's what
got me into jazz.
Was there an album that kind of changed your whole trajectory on how you wanted to go about? Like, what was the album that changed your life that you said, okay, I want to focus on just this?
Yeah. So I started out as a pop songwriter. So in the 80s, I did the pop songwriting thing, and I got cuts with Randy Crawford and Stephanie Mills and LTD and other acts that you've never heard of. You know, I went up and down Santa Monica Boulevard. That's where all the publishers were.
Right.
And every week with my songs, and I'd play them on the piano. And most of them I didn't get published. Some of them I got published. Some of them I got recorded. And I was in a songwriters group. And then around 1971, I heard this album, well, three albums. Al Jarreau,
yes,
who was at this club. I forgot the name of the club in the Valley. Blah Blah Cafe. And I loved him. I loved a wonderful male jazz singer named Mark Murphy. and he did an album called Bop for Kerouac. And I love that. And I love the Manhattan Transfer. So then I started going into jazz, and then I started working with a band that was like in, when they weren't doing weddings, like with me, they were like Tom Scott and the Express.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So it all sort of, and I wasn't a rock singer. I tried, you know, I did my best, but I wasn't a rock singer. So that got me into, I had a lot of songs recorded, no hits, but songs recorded. And then I started writing sort of jazzy tunes.
That's cool because, you know, that was an amazing era where, you know, when you were going to all these publishing houses, they kind of owned all the studios. Like you had to have somebody kind of supporting you to get into these studios because they were the ones that kind of ran all of that part of the business. So I'm sure that was like your way to kind of get your foot in the door. But then you started seeing like around the 90s, I think people started doing a lot more of the independent records and it started breaking free.
Yeah, I made my first record. Nikki, I've made 22 albums.
Wow.
My new album, which is released in August, Hold On, is my 22nd album. My first album was in 1982. And when I made my first album, the record label out of Seattle, which I love to refer to as Oblivion Records, because but it was called First American, and I have good stories to tell about that label.
Please.
They offered me $2,500 to make my album.
Wow.
And I went to my friend and co-writer and I said, I can't do this album for $2,500. And he said, listen, Mark, you do this album and you'll be in the 2% of people who have albums out. Because, you know, nobody did home studios and making their own record and all that. That wasn't the way it was done then. And I did that album and it did pretty good, actually.
That's amazing. So they offered you $2,500 to make the record. Did they offer any promotion, marketing?
Yeah, printing, distribution, promotion, all that stuff.
Okay. So that at least they supplied that. That's at least.
Yeah. Yeah. And they had Diane Sherwood on the label and some other pianists and stuff, Tom Rainier. So that was the beginning. That was my first album.
What did you think you learned the most from that first experience?
That I could get on the radio.
Yeah.
You know, I did my first album and I'm going down the 405 in my little Honda. And all of a sudden on the jazz station, KCBA, I think. I don't know what the call letters were. They play Carmen McRae. I remember this. They play Carmen McRae with Cal Jader. And they said, next, Mark Winkler singing bebop. I got lost, you know. I got so excited, I got totally lost, didn't know where I was, you know.
And did you kind of feel like I've made it at this point?
Because yeah.
that's a big thing, you know.
It was a big accomplishment, and the record got great reviews. It was really well respected, and still is in Japan.
I've had
four different labels with that record in Japan. But the weird thing, okay, here's the really good dirty story, Nikki.
Here.
Okay, so they release it in 1982. 1983, I get a call, and it's the FBI.
Whoa.
And, yeah, and they say, did you release a record on First American? And I go, yeah, I did. And they said, did you ever notice that your copyright date is 1980? And I said, yeah, I've noticed. And they said, have you ever noticed there's a Norwegian name after the copyright? I said, yeah. And they said, well, this is it. The guy who was, well, he's passed away, so I don't think he can sue me. The guy who was the president of the label, who I have forgotten his name, he basically did a pyramid scheme where he went to Midwestern Norwegian farmers and sold albums. You want to be in the music business? I'll make you albums. And each of them gave him $10,000. So he gave me $2,500, kept, you know, made about $5,000, I guess, an album. And they said, we're suing him. We're taking him to court. And we want you to be our witness. We will fly you up to Seattle. And I said, oh, my God, you know. And so the day before I was supposed to go up to Seattle, they called and said, we don't need you. And they sent him up the river for 7 years.
Wow. That's so what? So he would basically hustle these people for this money?
Yeah, he basically, I guess, hustled. He actually, the guy, and I forgot his name, he was the manager of Louie, that song, Louie. Then the Raiders, Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Right.
That, he started with them. He was a hustler, very charming guy. And of course, and he sold me to a Norwegian farmer who's on my album, you know, his name.
That's crazy. And that must have made you think, wow, welcome to the music business. This is how it works.
Yeah. You know, I think the thing I discovered almost from the beginning of the music business is getting a check, getting paid is such a wonderful thing when it happens.
Right.
You know, that it's really hard to get paid. I work with David Benoit, who's a wonderful jazz pianist and famous. You know, he was on GRP and all these labels, Concord. And his record that broke through, I was on that record. And it sold a million copies. This wow. is 1987. It was number one at Tower Records. He got a big record deal because of this record that was on a small label. So, you know, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to be making some money. So I call him up like 8 months later and go, where's the royalties? And he goes, Mark, I have something terrible to tell you. The guy who owns the label took all the money and moved to Mexico.
What?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the name of the label was Spindle Top Records.
That's
and
crazy.
The guy was this, I forgot his name. But he took all the money, and there was quite a bit because it sold a million copies.
Right, right.
And moved to Mexico.
That's criminal.
No. So, you know, stories like this, you know, you're in the business. I've been in the business 45 years or something. You know, a lot's happened.
So what, did that make you more, like, fearful to sign with another label? Or were you just, like, willing to take a chance on another label? Or did you just want to be an independent artist at that point?
There really wasn't an independent artist at that point, or at least I didn't see myself as that. This is now we're going into like 19. So I made an album in 1982. I didn't make my next album to 1987.
Okay.
I got signed to another independent label, and they were trustworthy. They were a good label. And basically, this woman called me in the middle of the night, drunk, and said, I love your album. She says, I love this one song. They're playing it all the time on KBLX in San Francisco. I was on The Quiet Storm. Remember that format?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she said, if ever I'm in the position to help you, I will help you. And about 2 years later, she was one of the execs on the label, small label, and she signed me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you have a lawyer look at the
yes.
Okay, so you did all that.
So, you know, Nikki, the only time I haven't had a lawyer look at a contract was I did a record. I don't think these people are going to. I did a record with Varese Sarabande. It was the best of Mark Winkler, you know. But it was basically I was with all these big jazz artists, so they put the name of the jazz artist on the front. And I did it with a friend. Really nice guy. And the contract was really short. And he says, Mark, read the contract. I don't think you need a lawyer. And I read it. I understood it. It was very simple. And we put out the record, never get a royalty. Call him up and I go, where? I'm sure I sold something. Where's my royalties? And he went, well, if you look at paragraph 4, indent 5, you know, he started doing that. And I went, oh. So I never made any money from that record either.
That's crazy. And you know what? That's a part of the music industry that I always hope will never come back. And it always pops up in a new form. I'm sure you've seen that too.
Yes.
And so it's unfortunate. But did you have friends that were also on labels going through?
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure everybody was going through the same thing.
Yeah, you know, it was fun in the sense of I had a songwriters group that I guess we met for about 10 years. Some really talented people in the group who were signed to different labels, publishing deals. My best friend was signed to Irving Almo. you know, A&M's publishing deal. She was going out with a producer who produced Julio Iglesias. And I mean, everybody, you know, it was a lovely little world of us songwriters. I love songwriters.
Right.
And, you know, we wrote together. We traded war stories together, you know. So
what's difficult is you never know who's getting paid what, because all the terms are all different. And there's so many shysters that are running labels. And then, you know, like in the 50s and 60s and 70s, it was mobsters running these record labels.
You better believe it. I produced this girl singer and this label, small label, but they were associated with Universal at the time. We went out for a celebratory lunch. And the guy was really nice. And at the time, right at that time, a book called Hitmen came out.
Right.
About all the mobster connections with the record business. And I just happened to say to the guy, oh, have you read Hitmen? And he went, oh, yeah, I read it. And I said, is that true? You know, because he was in the business deeper than I was in a different capacity. And he said, oh, yeah, we're all family. So, and scared me. I went, oh, my God. OK, he's in the mafia. but, you know, the funny thing about jazz is, the people who are in jazz, in both the business side of it and the artist side of it, you're not in it for the money. You're right. In it because you love the music.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And it's also, you know, jazz labels, I've seen so many come and go because of that, because there really isn't a lot of money. And it's like, but the hardest thing too is like the way jazz labels like really kind of steal from jazz artists is probably the biggest crime in the music industry, because you'll see residuals in the pop world. You'll see it even in the classical world. But the jazz world, for some reason, is almost one of the most crooked parts of the business.
Yeah, I've had over 250 of my songs recorded. And except for the big labels that the artists have been on, I never get royalty statements from the little labels. Actually, I just hit up one of the little labels that I had a record out on that never gave me a royalty. It was 10 years. And I knew the album had done pretty well, you know. So I hit them up and they at first laughed. And I said, no, I'm going to get my lawyer involved because you haven't given me a royalty statement for 10 years. And I actually got some money from them. So great day, you know.
It's always good when that happens.
Yeah, it's always good.
So you went through these labels, then was there a moment where you said, okay, I'm going to just run my own ship and start like with my own band and my own musicians? What year was that? What record was that for you?
It was, okay, it was 1998. And 1998 was a very big year for me because at that time, so I had basically been a singer-songwriter up to that time.
Right.
And then 1997, I wrote songs for my first musical.
Oh, cool.
So my husband's best friend was the artistic director of this gay musical theater in Hollywood called the Celebration Theater.
Awesome.
And I'd go to his shows and he had some musicals. And so one night he comes over to our house and he says, you know, the only shows that do well at my theater are shows where the guys are naked or shows where there's guys are singing. So I'm going to put it together and I'm going to do a musical about naked guys singing called Naked Boys Singing. And the first thing I said to him, being a songwriter, is that's a great title. I really like that title. And he said, well, you write a couple of songs. The show is about nudity, a fun look at nudity. The show is very sweet. It's not dirty or nasty or anything.
I'm sure it's like cheek sort of.
So yeah, cheeky, yeah. So to speak. Every pun intended. I wrote songs. I wrote 2.5 songs for the show. And the show is a gigantic hit. It's the second longest running show in off-Broadway history. It's played every country all around the world.
Wow.
And I'm lucky enough to in those days, I had the CD. I owned the CD. I paid for the CD. And I made quite a bit of money on the CD because every production all over the world, including New York, for 22 years, they sold my CD. So that was a great boon. So that was 1998. Things were really cooking on that line. So I put out this new record, and I decided to do my own label.
Smart.
Because
I went through the cycles of labels in all the capacities. You know, you saw you working with in the pop world, jazz world, and getting signed, and then seeing like, okay, this is how little they're going to put towards the record. This is how little you're going to get back. It's like a shady business. So now you're on your own. And tell me what that difference for you was like compared to being with a label.
Well, I had complete control, and I'm a control freak, so I like that. So I wouldn't say that, you know, it's interesting. My first couple of albums were very, very successful. The first album on Oblivion Records did write really well. The second record was a big smash. So it was on this label called Pausa, which became Chase Music Group. And I had Joe Sample on it, and Diane Reeves, and Tom Scott, and Grant Guisman, and the Rippingtons, and David Benoit. And it was just one of those, everything was at the right time, you know, all the people. Right. And it sold a lot, you know, it sold like 15,000 copies, which seemed like nothing then. But now I go, wow, if I could sell 15,000 records, you know. And so that did really well. My next record did really well. The next one did it. And then what happened, I was in smooth jazz. So I will admit it. I was in smooth jazz. I never talk about that. Because, you know, Nikki, there's a big gap between smooth jazz and straight ahead jazz.
But you know what? The difference is also smooth jazz actually has a booming business, whereas jazz doesn't in the same way. It's unfortunate, but that's...
Well, smooth jazz did have a booming business. I don't think it's booming as much as it did in the 80s and 90s. But what happened in about, I don't know which year, 94, is... A marketing firm got associated with it called Broadcast Architecture. And they decided some things. And one of the things they decided is that all singers on smooth jazz, not instrumentalists, but singers, would be black. So people like Michael Franks and Basha and Mark Winkler, we weren't allowed to be on smooth jazz anymore.
That's crazy.
It was. And I had a friend who was with Broadcast Architecture, very nice guy. And he called me and he said, we just have done our research, and the people that they like the instrumentalists, they can be any color, but they want the, you know, it's Anita Baker, Luther Vandross, Vanessa Williams, you know, Al Jarreau, you know. So I had to make a decision. So I kept doing a couple of albums after that. And then in 2001, I made my first straight ahead album.
Wow.
And that was good. It was a good. And then the next year I did my Bobby Troup album, which sort of set the path for the next couple of years. Sort of defined who I was.
Came back to straight ahead.
Yeah.
Straight ahead. And then you left for smooth jazz. And then you saw the kind of like what the trends were.
Yeah. And I was lucky enough that I could adapt. That's the other thing. Things change. Things never stay the same. So the artists that are aware of the marketplace and what's happening are viable. And the ones who say, oh, man, smooth jazz, they're not playing me anymore, but they keep making smooth jazz records. No. You know, it's like I have friends who won't go on Spotify because Daniel Elk is an idiot. Of course he's an idiot.
Right.
But that's the name of the game. It's 34% of the market.
Yeah,
you know, you can bemoan it all you want, but that's the game.
I did bemoan it for a long time. And then one of my fans, I had three fans come up to me at different times. But the first one said, hey, I'm trying to show your music to other people and you're not on Spotify. And I explained it to her. I was like, well, you know, I'm just trying to like boycott it if I can. And then I had two other people in different states say the same thing. And I said, All right, I need to just put my music up on there. If I have fans that are trying to share my music and they can't, then I'm kind of shooting myself in the foot, you know. So now it's, you know what I mean, and it is a necessary evil, unfortunately. But
yeah, it is. It's a, you know, I like it in terms of what it is, because there's some interplay between you and the real playlist editors.
Right.
While Apple Music, you know, it's just all algorithms.
Right.
So, as I believe it, you know. So I try to keep up, and, you know, it's always changing. But so the last, I don't know, 15 albums, but in the last, my last four albums have done better than any of my other albums. So
that's awesome.
Which is great, you know? Well, so, yeah.
Play something from one of the records. What do you
want? Yeah, let's play. I have a new record out. It's on all streaming services. And which one? Play Train in the Desert. Well, let me tell you the story of Train in the Desert first. Hey. Okay. So, Nikki, for all of you listeners, we met through the Songwriting School of Los Angeles.
Yes.
We were on a panel, I guess just the two of us. Yeah. And that's how we met. And we're both teachers of songwriting. And I've been teaching at UCLA Extension for, I'm going into my 21st year.
Amazing.
So, you know, usually I'm very methodical about writing songs, but I went to a museum in New York. It was a Georgia O'Keeffe show. And I happened to see one of her paintings on the wall, and it was a train coming out of a dust cloud in the desert. And I immediately got the idea for the song, and I knew every bit about what was going to happen in the story and the title. And I wrote it really quickly, but it's a story song. And I really like this song, and it's on my new record. And then I went to Fiverr.com, and I had this guy do a video for me, you know, taking found footage, you know, that's not copyrighted. And so that's the story of that.
Awesome. Well, let's hear it. Here's Train by Mark Winkler.
On the train, the porters hustled and the businessmen talked big, read their papers and smoked their cigars. The sun was going down as she hurried to her seat, but she could still see the billows of smoke from the train following the boxcar, curling round the track like an angry black tail, until it too was swallowed up by the ink of the night. Soon the train was quiet as it raced through the sand and the dust and the dark.
Traveling on a train in the desert close to midnight, taking in the tumbleweeds and the cactus terrain. She was traveling on a train, traveling on a train. There was something in her hand, and she hid it from the dim light. It could free her from the regret and the pain. Something in her hand on this train, and the sad whistle blew, and the tracks clicked underneath it too. In her brain, an ugly night, he held her down, she couldn't fight. His sweat fell like hot drops of rain. She was sure what to do, 'cause only she and God and the coyotes knew. Thank you. traveling on this train. Couple rows ahead and to the right, and near his heart bloomed a crimson stain. He missed a stop on the train in a red desert rain. She got off and never looked back at the train in the desert, clickety-clack. The train in the desert. The train in the desert.
Cool vibe. I loved it.
Very true. That was Grant Guisman on guitar.
And what was the dialogue part of the song? What was the inspiration behind that?
I don't know. I've done dialogue before. Actually, in another one of my videos, I sort of do the verses as sort of a rap dialogue. I had never done that before. And I'm trying to do different things. You know, like I listen to the Beatles a lot lately, and I love their mashups. And I keep thinking I want to do a couple of mashups like that.
Ball of Paul behind me. I got to meet him, so there's a signed ticket stub somewhere.
Oh wow,
Beatles fan! I'm a huge Beatles fan.
Me too. Behind me, I don't want to do it because everything's. I've got the Beatles. The four Beatles are above my.
Oh, that's awesome! That's awesome. Yeah.
And their songs are so varied and wonderful, and every kind of song, you know, they wrote every kind of song.
Right.
They wrote standards and AABA story songs and rockers and, you know, novel, you know, music hall songs. They wrote everything.
And they made everything change as far as what was possible. That's what I love. It's like, they moved the needle way forward, you know.
They were moving the needle. You know, I was lucky enough. I was the generation of the Beatles. So every album that came out, we were waiting. We knew something new was going to be there. You know, a Revolution Number 9, Tomorrow Never Knows, you know, Day in the Life, Strawberry Fields Forever. You know, those were new. You know, I'd never heard anything like those things before.
Right. And they were just experimenting, which is what I think every artist should be doing when they're making records. So I love that you're experimenting with dialogue and you're trying to, you know, do something that is like a different, you know, avenue than you're used to. Tell me, if you were going to set up the next song, tell me a little backstory behind the next song and maybe how experiments, you know, being experimental in the recording process helped.
Well, this next song, Cat Women on the Moon, I love old sci-fi movies. Cool. So, you know, Nikki, when I'm doing my albums, I write about me, what I like, what I'm feeling, what I'm going through. I've never been one of these writers who makes stuff up. I made up this story, but the song Train in the Desert is like a film noir from the 40s. So it's something I love. So this next song, I love this 50s movie called Queen of Outer Space, starring Zsa Zsa Gabor. And it's a really campy movie in Technicolor with all these Miss America girls on the moon, you know, in little cocktail dresses, you know, drinking drinks. And it's a campy movie, but it's great. So I wanted to write a song like that. So basically, it's another story song. And it's a little bit out of the jazz genre. But it's a cha-cha. And it's got a big band in it. And I put a theremin in it because there was a theremin in the soundtrack.
Was the cha-cha for Zsa-Zsa?
Cha-cha for Zsa-Zsa. That's good. No, I guess so. You know, I wrote it with a wonderful guy named Jameson Trotter, and he did not write it as a cha-cha. So he sends me the song, and I go, this is a lot of, this is great, but it would be a lot more fun if it was a cha-cha. Because the song is fun, you'll see.
Right.
And he said, oh, great. And he's one of these guys, he's got a million ideas. So he sent me back the demo, and it was a cha-cha, and it was great. So, and I've got a big band, and you'll see some of them. Jameson's playing the piano.
Did you
got a horn section?
Kind of do the hand motions, or did somebody else do it?
We didn't film the person doing the theremin.
Okay, that would have been cool.
I know, right? Why didn't you know? Anyway,
what's the name of the song one more time?
Cat Women on the Moon.
Here's Cat Women on the Moon by Mark Winkler.
Yeah.
Lounging, drinking, somewhere near the sea of tranquility. Lovely misses in cocktail dresses defy the laws of gravity. Make a beeline, sly and feline, for us boys from planet Earth. Getting drunk on lunar fizzes. These chicks are whizzes in love. Feeling crazy as a loon for these cat women on the moon. Singing, swinging, ring-a-dinging. The band begins to play. From all humanity, Matt and Kitty do what ditty. It's a bachelor's fantasy. Getting drunk on lunar kisses. These chicks are whizzes of love. Feeling crazy as a loon for these cat women on the moon. Lurking here, dressed up in a rubber suit. Maybe there's an evil queen or two. Before the lady calls it quits, I think it's time we split and have a rendezvous with our rocket ship. Young and dateless, going for a stroll, alone in the dunes. I get hit on, scratched and bit on. It's like I'm catnip on the moon. In my spacesuit, looking damn cute. I got them purring to my tune. They're passing all my quizzes. These girls are whizzes in love. Feeling crazy as a loon for these cat women. Cat women. Cat women.
Fun. That was such a fun video.
Thank you.
How did you get the footage for the film?
My videographer, David Haverty, just went to different things that weren't copyrighted. I don't know how they do that, but they...
That was awesome. It was so cool. And you, did you film it live? Like, was the recording live?
Yeah, he was there during the I have the two tracking dates. So then the stuff where I'm singing, we came back and did that after I did the real vocal and I lip synced to it.
That's awesome.
But the musicians, it was the tracking date.
That's very, very cool. Well, it just looks like it's live and fun and, you know, it's a little bit like quirky, but also like it's got some jazz and vibe influence too. So it's sophisticated. You kind of hit all the things with this.
Well, you know, the thing I like about it, Nikki, is I have a lot of double rhymes in it.
Right.
So, you know, I've got like fizzes and kisses, singing, swinging, kitty, ditty. You know, I just went crazy, you know, weightless, mateless. So I use like my songwriting technique. So when I came up with that first verse, like thinking, lounging, drinking or whatever, I went, oh, this is a lot of double rhymes. And I said, oh, this is fun. So I continued doing that and made it fun and sophisticated sounding.
Yeah. Did you, like, tell me about your creative process.
Yeah.
Write on piano? Do you write just for melodies?
So I'm a lyricist most of the time.
Okay.
So I write a lot of the time. I've been writing with this one guy, but I'm a songwriting slut.
Right.
I write with a lot of people.
Right.
And it's great. But I've been this record. I think there's five songs with this one guy, Greg Gordon Smith, and Train in the Desert was with him. But this one was with my crazy friend Jameson Trotter. I came up with a lyric first, and then gave it to him. But I do it always. You know, he could give me a melody, and I'll come up with a lyric, or I'll give him a partial title idea, and we'll work on it together. So it's all different ways, but mainly I do give mostly lyrics to people.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, it's like the things that you gravitate towards are the things that you end up creating, you know? So
yeah,
you must have fallen in love with lyricists like Bernie Taupin or, you know, even who else is
Randy Newman.
Randy Newman, and also the Beatles. I was going to say the Beatles.
The Beatles, you know, like, you know, Rocky Raccoon and all those story songs, you know, She's Leaving Home. I love, once again, this is a story song. So the other thing I like about this song, and it's not done that often, is the main character isn't me. I'm an astronaut who's landed on the moon in the 50s with all these girls. So I'm not Mark Winkler in the song.
Right.
And I love it when, I always tell my students, you do not have to be yourself in the song. You can be stupider. You can be smarter. You know, like Randy Newman plays different roles in his songs and he gets into trouble because people think, oh, he doesn't like short people. No, it's the stupid guy in his song who doesn't like short
right,
people.
Right.
So well, I love to play characters sometimes.
I love that. I love that. So tell me, for this new record, what was the vision for the new record? You've done all these records.
Yeah.
Made you want to make this next record?
Well, I think the last two records, Late Bloomin' Jazz Man, which you're going to hear in a minute, and The Rules Don't Apply, just did great on the jazz charts. Right. One was 7, one was 4 on the jazz charts.
Awesome.
I was real excited because I'd never gotten to that point. And then I started writing with this guy, Greg Gordon Smith, who is just a fantastic melody writer. You know, because what I wind up happening... So, Nikki, you write everything. Do you write the lyrics and the music?
Yes. Yes.
I went on a Nikki voyage right before our show tonight, and I played a lot of your stuff. I really like your tunes. I like Revolution. I like that song.
Good one. There's a lot of wordplay in that one.
Yeah. So, so you write everything, which I think is fantastic. And I want to actually write more melodies now. I'm writing more melodies now. But I met this guy through actually a student of mine. And he, a very sophisticated piano player, but he can orchestrate. We've got the similar musical. He's 25 years younger than me. Right. But we've got similar musical
influences.
Influences, thank you.
That's cool.
And we work great together. So that really was one of the big influences for me to do the record.
Creative, like in any capacity. You know, it's like sometimes I'll write people and it's like, even though I'm doing everything, I don't come in saying I'm going to do everything. I like collaborating where it's like, if you see someone's really great at something, let them be really great at something.
Let them go.
Yes.
You know, like the trumpet player on Cat Women on the Moon, you know, we knew we wanted him to play a trumpet solo, but we didn't write it out. We had him do what he wanted to do, and he got crazy and wild, and it was great.
Well, that's what's fun about music. It's like when you can see somebody turn it up, you know what I mean? And it's like, and then you really can see them shine, and it becomes like this collaborative process where everybody starts to shine as a result.
Yeah. And, you know, L.A., we have the best musicians.
I agree.
It's the great gift that my career has given me is working with these great guys. I have 6 different piano players on my record. Some of them are famous, you know, like John Beasley, he's Grammy winning.
Yeah.
And, Eric Reed and Tamir Hendelman. And, Greg and Rich Eames. I have these great musicians. Grant Geisman, who was in the Chuck Mangione band, did Feel So Good. I've got these fantastic musicians who give me so much.
Yeah, it's I think
the
best parts of making music with people is, you know, like sharing gifts. And when you share your musical gifts, like great things come from it. And that's what, you know, I think every audience and music fan gets the benefit from.
So, yeah. It's great.
It's important. It's like what it's all about. Let's play something else. What are we going to play next?
So this one was the title song of my album 2 albums ago called The Late Bloomin' Jazz Man. And this got the birth of this song was that I was at a jazz convention with these jazz promoters. And they were talking about the latest 20-year-old who was big in jazz, you know. We were actually at a concert of this guy who was a fantastic guitarist, and he was in his 60s. And they were talking about the latest young girl singer. And I said, well, what about this guy? And to be honest, I forgot his name. And they said, oh, yeah, he's great, but what about? And I got really mad. I said, you know, this guy's great, but he's older. So naturally, I related. And I thought, okay, I'm going to write it's my protest song, really.
Right.
And it's angry. So that's what started it. And then I wrote it with this great guy who's the musical director of Saturday Night Live, and I've known him since he was 20 years old. And he was a songwriting student of mine. And he's now been in New York for 12 years, I think, doing Saturday Night Live.
Wait, who
is it? He wrote the music. What?
Who is it?
Eli Brueggemann.
Yeah, I know Eli.
Eli, do you know Eli?
Eli went to USC. He went to
That's
USC.
Right.
Yes. So I actually just reconnected with him recently because he knows Jared Scharf, who is a friend of mine who played in the SNL band too for years. And it's just a small world, but he's great.
He's such a great guy, you know? And the thing I love about Eli and what I love about musicians is, you know, he'll look at me and this is Eli's quote, you phrase like LL Cool J.
That's cool. That's cool.
And you know, he just jumps genres.
Yeah.
So yes, he can play jazz with the best of them, but he also listens to rap. He also listens to, you know, he's married to a lady from Costa Rica. So he's really into Latin music. You know, he just can do anything. And he's a really nice guy to boot.
Yeah. talking to Brad Meldow. I reminded him of that because I said, man, you showed me Brad Meldow, who's one of my favorite pianists and jazz artists. And we talked a lot about Brad Meldow and jazz and just like some of the modern cats. So it was so great. He's just like a musical guy and just as always.
So. Well, let me give you one more Eli story. So I did an album 13 years ago, doing the music of this singer-songwriter that I absolutely love, Laura Nyro.
Okay.
Yeah. And she wrote Stone Soul Picnic, Wedding Bell Blues, Sweet Blindness, and When I Die, you know, but she's not as well known as Carole King or James Taylor, but I'm crazy. Do you know her? You know who she is, Nikki? Okay, look up Laura Nyro. She's okay. Like the bomb.
Okay.
So I wanted to do an album of Laura Nyro music, and I had a really hard time with jazz musicians. You know, I got two different ones, and they said, we don't get this. I go to Eli, and I play him Time and Love, which is one of her songs. And I said, I want to do this sort of as a ballad, even though it's a shuffle. And he looked at me, and he said, this has the same chord progression as Amma Jamal's Moonlight in Vermont. Wow. He said, I'm going to do the Moonlight in Vermont arrangement and put it over the Laura Nyro song. I mean, that's the way this guy thinks.
Yeah.
And we did the whole album together, and it's wonderful.
He's great at music. That's what I love about him.
He's great. So this song's Late Bloomin' Jazz Man.
Here's Late Bloomin' Jazz Man by Mark Winkler.
Loves the possibilities of the young, all the brutal realities go unsung. They're young lions, they always seem to have their day. Now don't they? Don't they? While the world shoves aside the particular hipsters who play, who've paid their dues and lived a little bit long away. But watching you tonight, I know the world is wrong. So wrong. You're playing stronger, the longer in the tooth, the notes you convey in are the stone cold honest truth. You're playing better than in your well-regarded youth. You're a late-blooming jazz man, late-blooming jazz man. And one thing's very clear, your finest flowers finally here. Sometimes the world's fooled by the innocence of a child. Their loud unschooled dissonance drives them wild. The prodigies come and go. Now don't they? Don't they? So when the world sees a player with a lifetime of experience, why does it turn away, look away, when it's clear that they've got so much left to say? Playing sweeter, and you've always had the touch. Now you're the master, not too little, not too much. Pick in one note that can say just what you feel. You're a late blooming jazz man, great blooming jazz man. And one thing's very clear, your finest flower's finally here. Ba-do-ba-da-da-da-da. the touch, but now you're the master. Not too little, not too much. Pick in one note that can say just what you feel. You're a late bloomin' jazz man, great bloomin' jazz man. And one thing's very clear: your finest flower is finally here. Your finest flower, your finest flower is finally loves the possibilities of the young. All the brutal realities go unsung. They're young lions, they always seem to have their day. Now, don't they? Don't they?
So awesome. Very, very cool. I love the inspiration behind it.
Just thank you.
Very good vibe. So where can people find you if they want to find your music online?
MarkWinklerMusic.com. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Blue Sky, I'm on X. You know, just put Mark Winkler Jazz and you'll find me.
I love it. Well, Mark, we're going to have you back in about 9-10 months.
So all right. We just got started, Nikki.
Right. I know. But that's what makes this fun. So, you know what's cool is, like, you've done a lot of records.
Yeah.
So remember the songs you played, because I'm going to have you back on and we can just keep featuring new songs.
Okay.
Keep this story, you know, moving and shaking.
Well, good. And let's have lunch.
I'm down. What? Where are you?
I'm in Studio City.
Okay. We're not far. We'll make that happen.
Okay.
Well, on behalf of Mark, myself, and Sam, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you guys next week. Check out Mark Winkler's music, markwinklermusic.com. Is that right? Is that correct?
That's right.
Markwinklermusic.com. Check out his music. Check him out when he's doing shows, and check out his new record. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you guys next week. Peace, love, and hair grease.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.